Hello, it's the Ghost. Welcome to your weekly dose of the real world, where truth is stranger than fiction and things are not always as they seem. Today's episode has to do with the famous Oak Island, and even more than the mystery treasure island itself, this story has to do with treasures and old relics that at one time meant something to those who tucked it all away. The Knights Templar. Were they the protectors of great treasures? Over all these years, they've captivated us. We seem to have an inevitable curiosity of things we do not know, especially those things from a long time ago, or things we do not have full and readily available answers to. Today is an instant gratification world, after all. Yet even with all the things we want and expect as on-demand as we do, people are fascinated by the idea that there is still something amazing out there that they, the Knights Templar, have left behind. And we accept this. In their time, what did it all mean, though? And in our time, what is it we might find? When I'm called on for this job, it was familiar. It was not a surprise that the request pertaining to this would come through, eventually. The mystery of the Knights, the secrets of Oak Island. It was not done. They call me the Ghost. I was an agent for the CIA, but today I'm an independent operative working on the side of the mysterious and unbelievable. And today is a story of patience and passion, meaning and greed. Take a listen and enjoy. As always, I've changed the names of all involved and changed other exact details as well, keeping the feel and the mood of what went on, while protecting privacy where need be. When this request came in, it was a lot like the last time I was called to Oak Island. It came in while I was away. Harley was the receiver of it, and she had already started her digging by the time I arrived. The same thing happened this time. We had all been on a job, actually together, in Switzerland, but when most of my team returned home, Frankie and I stayed behind for a few days. And anyway, we got back, and Harley just had this big smile on her face. Although only a lookout on the job with Lucas, we all were very emotionally invested in that job. From the emotional mother who believed, Carrie, the journey and how meaningful that was, and then knowing the little boy could go on to live his life, but the Templar in him could get the job done. It was very fulfilling for all of us to know that we touched that. This request came in from a man this time, and he tells me he's in France, although he himself is English. A Mr. Dane Atherton. He referred to Carrie's husband as to how he got my information. Carrie's husband, if you remember, the billionaire who mines diamonds and knows a lot of people, including Mr. Atherton, through a few degrees of separation. Mr. Atherton is also an heir, but of a different world, that of art and old artifacts. Tells me art is his interest and his job, and that artifacts are his passion. He also tells me that he is on the hunt for one item now that is not something he himself would go after, nor would he send in any of his suits. He throws in a hint and tells me that he knows of my job before and my delivery to Africa. Says his job could be considered a horse of that color, as Shakespeare would say. Without knowing any other specifics, I know what type of job this is. Seeing this request come in, although from someone completely different, we knew it was similar or along the same lines as that Lucas job, and it gave us a feeling. Things were put, hidden, stored, saved, however you want to look at it, on Oak Island for a reason. For those placing the items there, it was a place farther away, a place where they knew their setup would stick, and when the wave of new people came upon it, it would be the island itself that would protect what they had, with their last wish being that the right people would realize put the clues together, and they would come, and these items could continue their journey home. Now, Harley's already been digging into this whole thing, like I said, and she's just grinning. She knows this one would be delicate. We could run into obstacles and people who do not want us to get this done, but she also knows we can't turn it down. And of course, we don't plan to. What I do need to do at first, though, is to meet Mr. Atherton, per his request, in Paris. And, you know, just hearing those words come out of my mouth, it makes me want to explain something to you. You know, I don't fly around the world for different meetings for every job, but a lot of times I do. And it seems like a big thing to fly all the way to Paris just for a meeting from the US. But you have to remember how big these jobs are. There's a lot to this. There's a lot that gets left out of the stories that I try to share here. And I just want you to have a good perspective on everything. These jobs are big time. They're important. They need to be done very discreetly, and privacy is a must. Taking on a job like this means we need to be willing to travel. We need to be willing to put ourselves at risk. We need to be little detectives in a James Bond sort of way. The jobs can push our limits both physically and mentally, and we need to be financially set in a way that we can go wherever we need to go and have the things that we need when we get there. So I just wanted to explain that just a little bit. I hope that helps put some of that in perspective for you. You know, a trip over to France is just a tiny piece of all that this job would finally be. So although it might seem like a big deal to some, it is not by a long shot the biggest thing going on here. Okay, so Harley's pulled everything she can on this guy, who he is and what he does. It's not a secret that he has a particular interest in the Knights Templar and has for some time. Some would even say he's sensitive about it, which tells me that there's probably something personal about all of this to him. I hope to find out what all that means. There's no reason to put any of it off, and I know that this requester is anxiously awaiting for me to get to Paris, so that's what I do. I hop on a plane, and with some good jet lag behind me, I land in Paris the following day, get myself settled. I do get a small nap in, but I'm up in time to meet Mr. Atherton. He made reservations for us in a private dining room at a restaurant in the city, and it was a nice place. A nice place, but comfortable, which was perfect. He welcomes me into our private space. He's got food and things laid out for us for when we talk, and once I get there, he tells the waiter that there will be nothing else. He tells me that I can call him Dane. He's a very calm guy, but very distinguished, you know, polished, perfect table etiquette, that kind of guy. He doesn't seem to get nervous at all. And he calmly starts to tell me about what he has going on. Tells me a little bit about what he does and how that work feeds into his personal interest and vice versa. How his personal interest lies with the knights and the legends around them and the truths, as well as the many unanswered questions. And then he asks me if I know of Jacques de Molay. And I do. And I tell him I'm aware that he is the last Grand Master of the Knights Templar before they were taken down. I'm also aware that he was finally taken down himself and burned to death in front of a group of people in Paris. If we're dealing with anything Molay, that would make sense that we're in Paris for this meeting. If you believe Molay was a good man, if you know about this, then his death in Paris was a sad one. Molay has been written about and talked about over time, and many know of him. Some of you do, I'm sure. On top of Jacques Molay being the subject of stories throughout the years, his sword has been as well. There have been many explanations as to where that sword disappeared to and why, but none of those stories were really an answer to where it is now. Why hasn't anyone found it? Dane tells me, though, that he does know, and that's why he's called on me. He wants me to go get it. So, you know, I hear this and I'm thinking, this sword that's been missing for a lot of years, he wants me to go get it. Well, you know, I can't wait to hear more about that. How is this going to happen? In Dane's years of research and trailing objects on their different supposed paths throughout history, he's tracked down quite a few items. With regards to Molay and his sword, Dane says it's a story of loyalty, honor, and faith. Loyalty and honor to his people and a faith in what is right and the truth. So, real quick here, if you do not know Knights Templar, let me give you just a little bit of background. The Knights were basically the result of the successes of the First Crusade. And even in that, many get the two confused, a Templar versus a Crusader. But they are, in fact, different. A Crusader vows to engage in a crusade that will eventually end, a fight that will come to an end. He's a fighter. A Templar, however, is permanent. A Templar dedicates himself to communal living as a monk, but he also will act as a knight to defend Christian places and people. The Knights Templar are really a paradox, being a monk and a soldier, but so they were. After that First Crusade, many were left behind to stand as an army for the Kingdom of Jerusalem. A good idea, but they were also very far away from their own people and support. Long story short, the solution to that was a brotherhood. The brotherhood of those willing to defend the people on pilgrimage to holy places and the holy places themselves. This first group of Templars was established at the Temple Mount, a special wing given to them, and this is how they ended up with their name, Knights Templar. Well, this very small group turned into a large international organization with lots of resources and lots of money. They became a very large order, but they were still soldiers, and they were still fighting monks. Well, when King Philip decided that he wanted to start borrowing money from the order, everything was great, till it came time for him to start paying things back. He didn't quite have what it took to take care of that matter, and instead turned on the order, encouraging the Pope to join him. And this one decision, was the beginning of the end for the Knights Templar. At the end of the line in the setup by Pope Clement and King Philip, the Knights Templar were being taken out one by one and in groups. Strong men forced into false confessions to avoid death. Others were tortured and killed in brutal murders. Dane tells me that in all of this, Jacques proclaimed, "Let this sword represent our innocence. The sword is truth." He knew they were being ripped of their position, stripped of their successes. He also was well aware that it was not them inflicting any harm, it was harm being done to them, individually and as a group, and it was wrong. Molé got a message out to his men as they approached their final hours that they would not be forgotten and would not die in vain. He would see to it. Jacques de Molay, the final Grand Master of the Order, he would not be forgotten and would be remembered as a leader. Molay said that when all was done and this event would come to pass, the Order would never be the same again. It could never return as it was. And it was his sword, admired by many, that would represent who and what they really were. As others went before him, he went on to face his own death and did it with a brave face and did not show fear or pain as he was lit on fire. In his last moments, he claimed his innocence, taking back any false confessions forced on him. And then he put out a curse on the Pope and the King that their deaths would follow within a year and one day. And they did, and even more deaths followed those. So, was the man innocent? And did the king just want to avoid a debt? Or were those knights morally wrong and corrupt, as the king said, with the Pope's support? According to Dane, they were anything but morally wrong and corrupt, and he tells me it's not complicated. The Knights Templar were wealthy, and some took and borrowed too much from them, couldn't handle it, like the king, and this was a big cover-up for those issues. Well, the joke was on them with that curse, and they knew it. The Pope at least realized his wrongs and tried to do something about it. Within that year, the Pope absolved Molay, as seen in the Chinon parchment. He knew that there was wrong going on there. People died. But the relief of crimes came too late. It was all done. Molay had been put to death, and the curse was out there. Many were put to death, yes, and the order was taken down. The curse was powerful, and more died, but that was not the end of the story. Lost in it all was that sword, the great Molay sword. Some say his trusted sword was stolen in war by those greedy enough to take it. Some say he left it as a votive relic in Spain at Camino de Santiago. Dane is certain that no one took it, and although something might have been left at Camino, it was not the famous sword, the one item meant to hold the spirit of the Knights Templar, their energies and their truths. This thing became more than a sword. To them, it became more of a talisman. They saw it as something that brought them together, something of strong energy and good luck. "You can kill a man, but you cannot kill the great sword," they would say. "The sword is us." When given the chance, each man held it with such a great concentration. It was as if they were passing all that they were right into it. And Dane says that sword made it out. He says it was all pre-planned and that everything was taken care of. Those that made it out were not a fluke. It was not a mistake and it was not luck. They all vowed to not divulge their secrets of what they had or what they were, but legend says that what they took with them was a load for sure. Some say they even had a part of the true cross. But what Dane is interested in is that sword, and he says it was part of what was taken by those knights that made their way over to Nova Scotia. Is there proof of this? Well, no, and there was not meant to be proof. But could anyone prove that this theory is wrong? Well, by design, no, they could not. Dane offers up another piece of interesting information and tells me that he is generations, many generations, down from the knights of that time, the time of their fall. Not directly, of course. I mean, the knights took their oath, that of a monk, but of one knight's brother. Family, not brotherhood. He breaks out a box, tells me it's one of many, holds the secrets to what happened with Molay. And he shows me this to make it clear how many years and how much work it took to actually translate everything that was there. Of course, they meant to leave clear instructions, but they also meant it for the right people, people that would understand. And it took a guy like Atherton to get it done. Well, finish the job. Remember, there were many that came before him. As for everyone else, Dane says it's been a great thing. Everyone interested in the legends and treasure. People aren't looking across the families. Sure, there are people that are looking at DNA these days and things like that, but to be a link, a purposeful link, is a whole different story. In a safe, he has items from a time that we like to dream and fantasize and wonder about. But these were real men with real items, real feelings, and a real faith in what their purpose was. We, in this meeting, sort of pause for a moment after he tells me all that because it's pretty heavy stuff. And then in a softer voice, Dane looks at me and says that he can only hope that they can look down on him now for the mission that they bestowed on his line and know that he is doing the right thing. Says he can feel their presence. And then he leans in and flat out asks me if he can count on me and the team. Says we come recommended as the best and the time is now to decide. I mean, this is serious business, and my response to that is that we are the most careful with things like this, and that we will do our best, but we're not knights of old, and we would be going in a little bit blind here, but that we could give it our best shot. We can try to do our best. And that answer seems to satisfy him. He retreats back into his chair, taps his fingers on the table as if he's thinking, and then he looks up at me and he smiles. All he says is, "Let's get started." And so, there we were, Mr. Dane Atherton and I. I had the story, I had the information, and so we went over the mission. What I've got overall, you know, in this view into this thing. So, Dane claims to know without a doubt that the sword is hidden on Oak Island, right? He tells me that this relic holds the energy of the Knights Templar, and with the people now invading Oak Island, in a way, seeking out what's there, it absolutely needs to be removed from what has proven to be a very safe and secure spot. Once again, I would go to Oak Island in Nova Scotia and to a place that no one else in history has been able to get to. We know that there are people on the island at that time. Apparently, there's a lot of filming going on right at that time, so we need to be careful because we can't wait and we'll have to take extra care so as to not draw attention to ourselves. Dane tells me that he can get us there, but we will have only one shot to get it right. This hidden location is meant for those that know, and there could be no mistakes. Once found, the sword must be brought back to France, to La Rochelle, where the knights left from. The sword is to be reunited with Molay's ashes. He was burned alive, but because there were those secretly working on the side of the knights, all was not lost. It was all pretty straightforward. Not exactly easy, but straightforward. My only question was, why had he waited? Why have they all waited? There was no other keeper before him that could have gone in to get this sword, spread the ashes, and get them to permanent security? His answer was, well, sure, there were plenty of generations before him that could have tried to go in and get this done, but those days before were not the right time, and the directions and instructions were not fully deciphered, not with the 100% confidence that Dane felt they had now, anyway. There was no room for mistakes here. That everyone knew, and for quite a few generations before now, it was accepted as impossible, something that just would have to wait. Certain things had to happen before this could or should be done and disturbed. He didn't go into all of what that was, you know, the requirements or what made the ideal situation for bringing the sword up and out. He just told me that we were on the schedule of the human race and that people were moving fast. The hope would have been that we as a people would have matured by now to stop the fighting. But although we're moving fast, that has not happened, and people are moving in. It is time. This needs to be brought to a final resting place, kept safe, and out of the wrong hands. So, fair enough. I'm there to do a job, not analyze the wishes of set-to-be-put-to-death Knights Templar. But when Dane starts to tell me how we will have to get this done, more questions arise. He can't tell me enough times that there is only one way in and one way out, and it's a one-shot deal. And he invites me to his lab where he has tested the theory many times and many different ways. And let's remember, it wasn't like this was all written down, these instructions and directions in a clean and clear format like we might see today. The study of language and drawings and understanding back then had to be done, and only over time could the instructions fully make sense. It was really pretty incredible what they had accomplished and figured out. When we get to the lab, he's got this small room all set up just for this. There are three guys in there. They are friendly, and here is where I learn about what all would go on here. And quite bluntly, here's what we're looking at. When we get to our final destination, we will be met with sand and mud. Dan tells me it will look natural, as there will be a lot of that in that area. But when we get to the right spot, there will be a special pit of sand and mud. More sand than mud, and it will be sand mixed with water. Really, he says it will just look like dirty sand on the ground. No one would think anything of it. But the sand is special. It's the sand, he says, that will take me to the sword. Now, I've heard of quicksand, pretty much everyone has, and I'm hoping at that moment that's not what he means, but unfortunately it is. This sand will only work properly under the right weight and pressure also. I turn to him and he looks at me and tells me that there's another reason I was chosen and why this is so perfect. Not only have I proven myself on Oak Island before, I am the right person to go in. And I stop him to clarify that I'm the perfect person to go in. And does that mean that no one else can come with me? And his answer to that, unfortunately, is yes. And I had to take that one in for a minute, and I need to know more about it. He goes on to explain that should someone not weigh enough, there won't be enough pressure to get through. If someone tries to go in that weighs too much, the sand and water will suck them down and they will surely drown. Then he walks me over to a model that they have set up and they've tested over and over again. It's a pretty good size model, and he's using these weighted magnetic ovals to test it out, each weight acting as a person. First, he shows me the perfect pressure, and I can see how the weight is sucked down. I can also see how the sand settles in behind it. Being pulled down by the weight, this seals the chamber below it, not allowing any water, more than a few trickles, to go through. Using another magnet, he then shows me the weight moving through the chamber and up and out the other tunnel, which would be the exit side. That curves around, but it's on an incline, eventually pulling the magnet out the other side. There's only one thing missing from this model, he says, and that is what happens on the exit side. No one can enter through that side, or if they tried to, the rocks are laid in such a way that they would start to fall into the chamber, opening all kinds of different waterways. This would flood the chamber and close the entrance. You would never actually get there. Should that happen, the pressure being pulled into the chamber would also pull the sand from the other side, letting the water in from there as well, and any person on the inside at that point would essentially be buried and would drown. Unlike the magnet, when a person crawls through the intended exit, these rocks will still fall with every step. They will still open up those waterways. This person must be able to continue until they get out to avoid getting sucked down with everything and pulled back into the chamber. Hopefully, all of what's happening is behind them because they are moving forward. And once you are out, there's no way back in. The exit is closed. So like you said, one way in and one way out. I hope that makes sense. He shows me two more experiments, one with someone too light and one with someone too large. Too light and the sand at the bottom would never settle at the entrance. The water would fill up before they would even have a chance of trying to escape out the other side. Not to mention the water that would flood it would disrupt that exit anyway, and it would close. Should someone go in that's too large or heavy, the pressure from them would pull the sand through the entrance side. They would basically be going through quicksand to a quick death by drowning. I am the only one on my team at the height and weight that's required. So, there I am. He tells me I am the only one that can go in, but that he trusts me and that I'm perfect for the job. The only question at that point is if I want to back out, because now is the time for that. If not, we need to move forward. And it's a risky one, but I do agree to take this job. As a standard, we move in twos on my team, and in this case, I will be going in solo. I will have my backups, and all I can do is hope for the best. Dane has done so much testing. As long as I follow what he tells me step by step, I know I should be okay, but again, it's a risk. In the end, I do tell him yes. I don't look back, and I just put things into motion like he wanted. And I don't need to take you through all of the logistics and travel. Within 2 days, though, my team and I meet up in Nova Scotia. One of the smaller coves will provide us cover, as well as a direct line over to Oak Island. Now, this time, it's Jagger, Frankie, and Harley and I that will be traveling. They will be right with me. Ryder and Scarlett will be there, but they're going to stay back to track our path. They do, however, travel to the island with us, and they will be a base for us before returning to the mainland. I want everyone with me and as close as possible on this job because we need to be as invisible as we can. So the more eyes we have on everything, looking around to make sure that we don't run into anything or no one finds us, the better. And so to get there, we cannot take a boat over because there's extra security there at that time with the show going on. Even though we're pretty out of the way from what they're doing, it does make it harder to get where we need to be. And again, we need to be invisible. There is a lot going on, and really, with how busy this place seems to be getting, it does feel like it's a good idea to start getting more things out of Oak Island. So I'm feeling pretty good about this mission. We will be traveling underwater from the cove to our target landing point on the island. And okay, so we need ourselves, we need our scuba gear, and we need supply packs. That's a lot to take over. But the great thing is that we have something on our side, a little friend that we don't get to use very often, and we call it the Merman. We basically can hook up our supplies to it, hold onto it ourselves, and while controlling it from a lighted pad, we can propel our way from one point to another while staying underwater and out of sight. And we love the Merman. Get us where we need to go, and it's actually kind of fun. We just don't get to use it very often. This will not exactly be a joyride, but it's still nice to have. We'll be traveling in the middle of the night, so we're fitted with lights and everything that we need. At about 1:30 in the morning, that's when we take off. And it's later in September when we're doing this, so the water's a little bit chilly, but we're pretty good in our suits. We fly through the water, and it's actually a very smooth ride. It doesn't take us long at all. We're in full scuba gear in case anything goes wrong, but lucky for us, the Merman did his job. We get there fine. We have to stop before we actually hit land, though, and we anchor the Merman so that it stays underwater and out of sight, and it'll just be waiting for us when it's time to return. At that point, we gather up our gear, and we have to carry it all to shore and be set up, you know, in sort of a temporary camp where we will keep items and where we'll keep it as a place to meet up if we run into danger or we get separated, things like that. Scarlett and Ryder will be tied into us. They will stay there, and they'll be tied into us through our wrist computers so they can track us as we go, and they can also respond if we have to send out any emergency signals. We know that filming of the show starts early, and honestly, even if no one was supposed to be there, this mission has to remain secret, and so working at night would still be a good idea. We review again the map and instructions provided to us by Dane and the stuff that he gave us. It's very detailed. It had to be. One wrong move could wreck the entire job and the possibility of ever getting the sword out of there. We're traveling by night vision and compasses. We have energy sensors. If what Dane told us is true, the closer we get, the energy readings from the sword will rise. So for a while, we're making our way through thick brush, over fallen trees, through creeks, and no matter how hard or challenging that ever could have turned out to be, we all know, though, the four of us, because remember, it's me, Frankie, Jagger, and Harley. We all know what's waiting for us. It was a pretty quiet trek over to where we need to go, to say the least, but we do get there. Even though it's dark, we use the moonlight, and we have our lights to mark our area in a very detailed way, exactly where I need to go in, exactly where I should come out as well. Frankie and Jagger are there just in case anything happens on the exit side. I would hate to get sucked back into this thing at the last minute when I'm supposed to be out. Harley will stay at the entrance side. Dane has advised us how the sand should resettle and how things should look and be once I'm on the inside. If anything deviates from what he said, it should alert Harley that there's a problem. I myself am set up with oxygen and a protective suit. Even though I was told I could be buried down there forever, I'm bringing the oxygen and wearing the suit because I always hold out a small bit of hope that there's some way to get out, that it's possible. Didn't really sound like it, but why not at least be ready in case? The terrain cannot be exactly as it was all those years ago, but the directions are still clear. There are structures underneath the sand that I need to feel for with my feet, and those will direct me to the exact spot where I will go down. From the models and what Dane told me, traveling through this should go fairly quickly. The pressure will force me through. And so it's time. We know what's going on, we know what has to be done, and I go for it. Frankie and Jagger are in place, Harley's there with me. And it's in those moments that you really realize what's at risk on some of these jobs. You can see why telling them in the way that I do can be helpful to myself, therapeutic in a way, to relieve myself of the stress of the experience. This was one of those jobs. Anyway, it's time. Harley and I say our temporary goodbyes, and I start to walk, feeling my way along the path laid out for the chosen one, me as it turns out, to go retrieve this sword. I remind myself that they took a lot of time and care in tucking this thing away, and in the end, they did want it to be found. So all I need to do is follow the instructions that Dan has translated and tested repeatedly. And then I get to that point. One more step and I'm going in. And I remember it very clearly. I don't think I'll ever forget it. Stepping off that last piece of solid under my feet gave me a vision of stepping off a high-rise building or something. It wasn't the best of feelings, but I knew where I was going and I was on my mission and I was going to do it. So off I went. It's not like I got sucked down in 2 seconds or there was, you know, this big dramatic flash of light that took me in or something. A little bit at a time, I sank, and I just kept sinking. As Dane instructed me to, I put my hands over my head so that I would be as long as possible with no moving obstacles at my side. The oxygen tank that I'm using is light, and it's small, and it's inside my suit. Nothing meant to last too long, and nothing that would put me over the weight limit either. It was a strange feeling, going from the dark of night to pitch black in that sand. And then it went just as it was described to me. I got through that first layer of sand, thick sand and mud. And then there was more water that took over. And the force, it did pull me straight down, and before I knew it, I could feel myself sliding through an opening. I look up only to see my hands and the sand filling the hole where my hands passed through. Again, just like Dane said it would, and just like I observed in the experiment back at the lab. And I have to say, the feeling I had when I hit that rocky floor was overwhelming relief. I just had to sit there for a minute. I landed kind of hard as I was pretty much shoved through that hole. And I just stayed kind of squatted down for a couple of seconds. Then I flipped on some of my lights on my bands and I started to look around. What I saw was something beautiful. This chamber was long and thin. And I say long, I just mean it wasn't round. It was an elongated chamber, a cross between an oval and a rectangle. But as I'm looking across it, there's this large rock to my right, and around that on the wall, there were these paintings. Dane didn't tell me about the paintings, but he did know that the sword would be hidden or protected in some way down there. The painted markings were beautiful. I can't say what it all meant, but I can tell you how it made me feel. It was a welcoming. Just like the relief that I felt making it into the chamber in the first place, somehow what was painted there showed me the relief that whatever was there was waiting for. And seeing that, it did something to me, if that's what it was supposed to do. I had an instant rise in motivation and a burst of energy. I was instantly over the fact that I had just got sucked down into some sort of quicksand through a tiny hole into a chamber that no one can get into, and if I'm not careful, I can never get out of. It was time to get what I came for. I went over to this large rock and I took this deep breath. You know, this is where Frankie and Jagger really would have come in handy. My weight might have been perfect for getting there, but I'm certainly not, you know, a man of steel. This rock was big. It took me a while, but I did get it moved. And I can't tell you how many times while I was doing that, I looked at the entrance. I was just expecting the water to break through, but it did not. When I got the rock, or let's face it, a boulder, out of the way, I see this bright white cloth bunched up. I start to pull on it, and I'm pulling and pulling, and this thing is, like, never ending. Well, it's actually about 4 feet long. It was put inside this man-made dugout slot in the rock, like a deep cubby or shelf. I get this thing out, and it's a white cloth, so clean it was like it had never been touched. The only thing facing up on one end was the red Knights Templar cross. This thing is wrapped up neatly and perfectly. Whoever did this was careful to get it down there and in good form. And, well, I can't help myself, so I unwrap it just enough to see a very impressive handle to a long sword. Like the wall markings, it was beautiful, but in a different way. The man who had the sword used it and saw so many things. I ran my fingers over the surface decorated with carvings, and a shiver just ran through me as I did that. Sort of knocked me out of the awe I was in. I had to keep moving. This was my job. I needed to get it out of there. I close the one end back up, and I break out this long plastic bag that Dane gave me. I get the sword all wrapped up and ready for travel, and I go over to where my exit is, and I see it. And I wasn't all that excited about it, I can tell you that, but it had to be done. I had to crawl up the rock wall a bit, on some sort of camouflaged but intended steps. There was a crack just large enough to fit me at the top and in the corner. And I get through that, and it's also, just like I was told, there was this landing-type area, the only part of this tunnel that would be like that. You can't sit up, you can't really move around, but it's flat and it's smooth, and I have just enough room to make my way up through the slanted tunnel before me that I can see. There are rocks on every side of it, just like they explained, and I can see what they meant and what the experiments showed me. I can see how with every step I take on those rocks, they could start falling. And from what I'm told, I can only assume, there's water on the other side, so I move carefully. It's slanted in such a way that you can crawl forward for a little bit with your hands and arms, but eventually you do need to use your feet to push yourself up further and to the next level. As I passed the first level, I felt the rocks move under my feet, and I could hear the water starting to flow behind me. If you are overly claustrophobic or if you have anxiety issues, this would not work out so well for you. It's yet another time, another job, where our training, exercising, and preparing for how to remain calm, control our breathing, and everything else really comes in handy. It's all a mental game, really. If I were to panic in any way at that moment, it would have been over for me. And even though I was crawling and I was moving along slowly and carefully, it was right at the end that I ran into issues. I was kind of getting used to the rhythm, you know, of my steps and the sliding rocks and the sounds of the water. But then there was that last step. I actually could see some light coming from above. It was the moonlight. It was the best thing I'd ever seen. But the rock I put my foot on to get that one bit closer to it gave out. And then the others that I had stepped on before, they all slid. And then I slid. I actually slid backwards, only now there were no rocks to stand on, not really. The ones I was using to help get me out were gone. Now, I was only moving about an inch at a time, and it was starting to get a little bit tense. I could hear more water flowing behind me, and I knew I was running out of time. I've got the sword. It's tied to me on my left side and kind of behind me. It's too tight to reach down if that starts to slip. All I can do is use my hands in front of me, basically. I am able to switch on my emergency red strobe light on my wristband as a warning to Frankie and Jagger. Maybe they will see it. I continue to make my way very slowly. But then there's another big slip. I can hear more water. Then I actually start to see water in front of me. Something has jostled the rock balance all around, and now there's water seeping in around my hands and my face. I start to hear a small rumbling, and all I can think of is that this place is about to cave in. And I close my eyes, and I don't want to move, but then I feel a hand. I was close enough to the top that Frankie was able to reach down and grab my hand, and he pulls me up just enough, and then Jagger grabs my other hand, and together, they pulled me out. And as they do that, I can feel and they can see the exit tunnel filling in with all of the rocks and just closing up behind me. When I'm out, we all turn around and we look at the hole that once was. There's nothing there now but rocks. We see a few bubbles of water pop through, but then it just settles down to nothing. If you were to walk by this place, you would have no idea there was anything going on under the surface at all. Same with the other side. If you were to see that, you'd honestly think it was just a bit of sand, dirty sand at that. And unless you felt like jumping around in it for a while, you'd just avoid it, you know, naturally. These Knights Templar really did know what they were doing. Without the instructions and directions, no one would have found this place or made it in or out of that place. And it's not like you could drill it or something. The whole thing would have just collapsed. It was a very intricate and carefully thought out system. It would be very hard to build something like that today without anyone knowing, especially in an area, you know, or surrounded by so much population. You've got Nova Scotia, Canada, and the U.S. The place is surrounded. Back then, there would have been no one. And they would have had all the time in the world to hide their items in a place that they would have thought was too far away for anyone to get to, at least for a very long time. We would not have that luxury today. It was something to appreciate. I was also very appreciative that I made it in and out okay. It was intense, to say the least. And the team. I mean, it wasn't all fun for them either. None of us like to watch another one of us go in and do something that could be very dangerous and go in alone. There's no backup. There was no way that anyone could come in and help me. Not really. And we all understood that when it was all done. Dane was absolutely right. It would have been impossible. And you can see how jobs like this, and really all our jobs, how they bring us as a team closer together. Aside from the general idea of the work that we do and how unique the jobs are, it's what we go through and the risks that we have to take that bring us together even more as a team each and every time. But okay, so I'm going to go now straight to the return because our travels back were just like they were getting there. It took time. We had to be very careful. It was starting to get light out, but we did make it out. Again, very grateful for the merman to speed things along. We travel back to France and get to Dane, and he's crazy excited in his own Dan Adderton way. Controlled excitement. He smiled, he admired the sword, he even cried. And I'll admit, this was going to be a hard job to let go of. We would never forget it. We just brought back something from centuries ago, something that embodied the lives and deaths of many men, the risks they took, and the people they protected, what their vows meant to them, and the oaths they took. These were men I don't even know if you could find today. It was really just very incredible to be a part of this. Much to my surprise, after we're back, Dane invites me and the entire team to go with him on the Swords and Ashes final journey. In Paris, the sword was reunited with the ashes of Jacques de Molay. The ashes were in an old stone pot that had been sealed, the seal only broken for the purpose of this final journey. And under the moonlight, the following night, Dane asked me to hold the sword out and above the stone memorial put in place where Jacques de Molay spent his last moments. With me holding the sword, Dane spreads the ashes over the sword and over the memorial. Once done, we all shared in a moment of silence, picturing all the people that would have been gathered around as he was burned to death right in front of them. Our next stop was La Rochelle. It was from here that the legend tells us the mysterious fleet supposedly left France and set sail with the knights and the treasures. Treasures never to be seen again. And those would be the final two stops in France, the place where Jacques de Molay's life came to an end and where the treasure's journey began. It would be the last bit of the living world that Molay's ashes or this sword would ever see, technically. It's time for them to go to their final resting place at that point, the archives, the secret archives at the Vatican. And Dane surprises us again when he invites us to accompany him to Italy. It was a dinner to be had, he said, a dinner to honor those who got the sword out safely. And what a dinner it was. Great food, ambiance, of course. How could it not be? But the biggest thing about all of it was the mood. And I know there are a lot of opinions that go around about the Vatican, but I can tell you this. When you're in the company of the right people and people ought to do the right things, you can almost become overwhelmed with a feeling of respect, a respect for them and the respect that comes from them for the things they care about. It's very hard to explain. In our normal lives, we're not around things like that. We just aren't. I can't even compare it to something that I could hope you could relate to. It's a feeling that quiets you inside and you realize there's so much more going on than you could ever know. So much history has happened before us, and so much more will happen when we are gone. They know this, and they respect it more than so many others that I've met along the way. And I can tell you this, bringing this sword to its final place of protection was not met with a greed or feeling of superiority for having the item handed off to them. The respect and the honor and excitement was for the items themselves, the ashes of Mole and his sword, that represented so much and so many men. We all left with the same feeling, that feeling that we can never forget. You know, there are things out there much bigger than us. And in the end, there was no way I could accept payment for this job, although Dane was more than willing and almost insistent. But none of us wanted that. What this sword represented was men that fought to protect, to keep the sword safe and protect it. Felt like the right thing to do. It was the right thing to do. And somehow, at the end of this job, it felt like there was just a little more right in the world. Something put where it should be. Something home for good. You sleep a little better at night knowing stuff like that. And that was my job, getting back to Oak Island. I will say this, with all there is to know, it's no surprise that people want to hunt for the treasures on the island. But also, in knowing what I know, just the little bits that I know, I feel confident in saying that I believe if it's something hidden away by those knights, good luck. We all took a small break after that job. There was a looming sense of nostalgia that we all felt for a history and past that we weren't even a part of. But we knew it existed, and we were fortunate enough to touch on it. We got to be a part of it in a small, tiny, minute way. But it still meant something, and it just felt right to take a break and honor it and be present and quiet in the lives we're lucky enough to have today. And that's the end. Thank you for listening today to this job. I appreciate you taking the time to be here with me this Friday, this weekend. Like, subscribe, turn on your notifications, and until next time, know that I always have more stories to share, and I will talk to you all soon.